It's one-on-one. I'm Charles Wolforth for a Coffee House Conversation with Julia O'Malley. She's kind of the face of the Anchorage Daily News. Her picture is on that column 3 times a week. But she's also somebody who's been around Anchorage her entire life. There's a great big road across South Anchorage that's got her name on it, so to speak.
Not my name.
Not your name, but your name that you inherited.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, tell us the story. What is the O'Malley Road? That's your grandfather, your great-grandfather?
It's not that interesting of a story. I mean, it's been told in more interesting ways than I'm about to tell it. But old Doc O'Malley had an office downtown where the Muffin Man used to be. And he also owned some land up on the hillside off O'Malley Road, apparently. And everybody had to sign some sort of petition to get that road paved. This is how it goes.
Oh, really?
And he offered, because his office was centrally located, to have the petition there.
Oh, I thought it was because he was such a great man.
No. And then people signed it, and he was the first one because it was at his office, and then they named the road after him.
And there weren't many people around here, so it's kind of easy to get your name on something.
It was, yes. I mean, he was a great man. He did a lot of good things, and he was a very dedicated doctor. Anchorage for many years, but that's probably not why the road was named after.
Now, my first knowledge about you was when you were doing a column, and I think you were a teenager still in high school, and it was really vivid, and it really felt like here's the voice of a real teenager, but with language and with a sense of place that really drew you in, and you immediately became a favorite part of the newspaper.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking about this because you and I had talked a bit. It's a lot easier to write about your personal inner life when you're a teenager than it is when you're an adult. And I don't know exactly why, except for when you're a teenager, you don't really care about the consequences of things so much.
Right. You don't know enough to be worried.
Yeah. So it's actually very freeing as a writer. And I had sort of like no consequences. I had no thought of consequences. And I had lots of really good teachers at the Daily News. You know, it was a different paper then. There was a lot of time spent with me developing ideas and voice, in particular. Kim Severson, who is at the New York Times now, spent a lot of time with me on that column.
So I remember this particular column. It's stuck in my head where you're going on a road trip to Denali and listening to Alanis Morissette blasting Alanis Morissette.
I'm glad you remember that. I conveniently forgot it, but yes.
But, I mean, you're really laying your life out there for people. I mean, is that part of being a columnist, is sort of being a public person?
Certainly as being a public person, you know, those kinds of columns are not the kinds of columns that I write now. You know, but that has helped me because there was a kind of vulnerability in those columns that gives people of many walks of life a sense of feeling like they know me before I come to interview them. So people who read those columns and remember them kind of feel like they have a sense of who I am. So it's helpful as a reporter because there's a sort of familiarity there that doesn't necessarily exist for everybody. I mean, in the same sense, they feel like they know me and they don't really. So there's a discomfort there as well. But
Do you feel like you can't put yourself into your column the same way now because you're an adult or?
It's just not called for in the same way. And the columns have a little bit more... they just have more weight, you know. They run in a different part of the paper. They deal with different sorts of issues, you know. There was, when they were in the paper 17 years ago, there were so many voices. I mean, there was a feature section, and now there isn't.
Yeah.
So it was just one of a menu of voices. And there were all kinds of sort of intimate things that were people were talking about in the paper because it was a different kind of paper. So now it's, you know, there's not a place for that. And I'm not necessarily comfortable with the same level of vulnerability that I was at that time, I think.
Yeah. As she nervously shifts in her chair.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's happened is that as the Daily News has shrunk because of whatever economic pressures exist from the changing media and from bad decisions that the McClatchy owner may have made and so forth, a lot less people there to put the newspaper together.
Yeah.
And your column takes a larger and larger part of that, so that recently you've had some columns where you've been breaking news. You've been at the top of the front page, which is an odd place for a column to be found.
I mean, I suppose so. you know, when we had a Metro section, there was a regular column that ran on that page with all of the other news, mm-hmm. you know, but those are old, that was a different, more old-timey feel for mm-hmm. it. So the position of my column in the paper, you know, and the fact that it has news value is kind of speaks to the changing character of newspapers. You know, you will find that more news is experiential. You'll find that, there is a slip into the eye perspective in news stories in the New York Times, mm-hmm. you know. So my columns are reported because they don't work off the news. So, you know, I guess they are sort of a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Halfway between a news story and an opinion piece. For example, the piece that you did about Senator Murkowski and her vote on the contraception issue, it's almost a news story, and then at the end, you're sort of giving your opinion about what she should have done.
Yeah, it's not comfortable
Does
sometimes,
that feel funny?
Those
yeah.
That combination, you know, because it is my impulse to report things, and it is not my natural impulse to opinionate. Like, writing a column about life from your own experience is kind of one thing, but writing a column about what you think about something going on in Anchorage is something else, and I've never really loved that part of my job. It is part of my job, but mm-hmm. I've never loved it. But, you know, reporting, it's just easier for me. So I like to take people through my train of thought and how I get to someplace, how I get to a point of view, mm-hmm. Rather than just kind of rolling it downhill at them.
Yeah. So,
which I do sometimes.
You talked about doing this column when you were a teenager, essentially, and then you went away and you ended up back in Anchorage. And we were talking earlier, you were saying that you always knew that this was essentially what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And how would you remember when you first knew, okay, I want to be a writer, I want to be a journalist?
I mean, I was carrying around like a little notebook at like Sioux City Elementary School on the playground with my friend Chris, like mm-hmm. observing people playing spy. And so, I mean, maybe it started then. I was like a really avid diary writer and, you know, my parents divorced and I chronicled the whole thing. And, so I was always sort of processing the world through writing it down. And it was really natural for me to start writing columns that way. And column writing happened at such a early part of my life that I think that I process the world that way. Like, I like to report things and write them down. It's become sort of part of my natural way of behaving. So it's, yeah, I guess.
So when life is going by, do you have it flashing in your mind as how would I write about this?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, sometimes things, and I like for things to be funny usually. And sometimes things are not funny, you know, but, yeah. I often think, how would I write about this? But more often, I think, well, how did this get to be this way? What are the facts here? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's always been sort of my feeling, is wanting to get to the base of it, you know?
So do you still have any of those diaries and writings you did as a kid? Never
somewhere,
look at those?
I'm sure it would be embarrassing. Yeah, I'm sure. They are somewhere, probably at my mother's house and in a box.
Yeah. And your mom is Sheila Selkrag, who was on the assembly, ran for mayor, was the planning director. Mm-hmm. How has being part of this sort of illustrious family affected you as an Anchorage resident?
Very illustrious.
People know your family. They've been around a long time, and you kind of have a place in the community that's pre-made, put it that way.
There's a certain richness to my experience of the place here because of the depth of connections that I have from growing up here. Mm-hmm. So it kind of lends itself to a familiarity with the place. I think that gives me confidence when I'm writing about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's nice to see all these stories playing out for such a long time, you know, in the community that is around my family. Mm-hmm. So I guess that makes any sense.
You're part of it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing.
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, I'm very lucky to have my parents watching my baby, and mm-hmm. you know, we have a lot of family in that sense. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you were a recent mom in the last 6 months.
Yes.
And you're married how long?
I guess we've been married since 2008. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I don't know if people know that you're married to a woman, Sarah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about how that you went to San Francisco. You told about how you got engaged, and that was, I thought, a very cute story.
You want me to tell that
story? Oh, yeah.
It had been our idea that we would get married because you could, you know.
To the news.
We had been together for 7 years, and we had lived in Portland when people were getting married, but I don't think we were quite ready at that point. And then we moved back here, and, you know, you could get married. And it just sort of struck me, you know, I had had this sense before that I would always be sort of missing out on that. And I'm a Leo. I have always liked the idea of having a wedding dress and a big party mm-hmm. and like that whole thing. And I had been sort of sad thinking that I would probably never have that, you know, as sort of celebration. I mean, in a very superficial way, that's sort of a way that I thought about it for many years. And then we got this idea that we'd do it, but, you know, we needed to have the proposal happen. And I decided that I was going to propose. And so Sarah had gotten knee surgery. And we had tickets to the Indigo Girls concert, which is like super cliche.
Super cliche because it was
listening to when I was 16 on my cassette deck, driving around, being wistful about being gay, you know. Uh-huh. There's something sort of sweet about it. And they came to town, and we were like, okay, what the heck? So she had knee surgery. She couldn't walk. And we hadn't really anticipated that. And so I bought her a wheelchair at the Goodwill with like an old, and it had like the old lady's name still on the like cushion, special extra cushioning in the seats. And so I wheeled her into the concert, and then she had like a special place for people in wheelchairs down at the front right next to the speakers. And also there was a whole bunch of the deaf community was there as well. Hadn't thought of it at the time when we sat down there, but they can feel the vibe. They were right next to the enormous speaker, so they can feel the vibration of the speaker. So it's really flipping loud over right there, which we didn't anticipate either. So anyway, so out comes.
So this is where you're going to pop the question.
Yeah, right. And I'm like, going to do it, and I just can't. And also I had chosen to wear like really high-heeled shoes, so I was like teetering around on high-heeled shoes pushing this wheelchair. And so I was thought I was going to do it, and I
just waited for the right moment.
Yeah, and, you know, it just nothing was working out. And then all of a sudden there was, like, Emily Saliers and Amy Ray, and they were super old because they're old now.
Yeah, right.
And, like, Emily Saliers has this kind of weird, like, tick. I don't know. Anyway, they were, like, out, and they were, like, strumming the guitar, and they're playing, like, probably the cheesiest song ever, which is Hammer and a Nail.
Uh-huh. I love that song.
Yeah, that's good that you do that. It's pretty Indigo Girls-y. It's deep in there. You know, you got to be a fan from the 80s. And anyway, so they're playing it, and it's super duper loud, so loud that, like, I can almost not think. And Sarah's sitting there, and I'm like, hey, do you want to get married? And she was like, yes. And that was kind of how it went. And
then the celebration commences.
Exactly, which was sort of like a high five, because she had her foot was like, wait, it was out, you know, the wheelchair had her foot out, so I was like, yeah, and that was all that really went.
Oh, wow.
I think.
What was the wedding experience like?
We had a big family, a huge, ridiculous family gathering up at Arctic Valley, and it was fun. The caterer said it was like a Democratic fundraiser in Fairbanks. People ate every single morsel. Uh-huh. 50 extra people showed up, and it was totally a blast. And then we went down to California, and we were married. We're part of the like 18,000 couples who got married
at City Hall. And then, I mean, how do you feel about that, about the fact that it's in limbo legally? And does that matter to you?
Well, it's not really. I mean, our marriages remain, you know, they are valid, and they continue to be valid. So for us, it's, you know, we're just a problem for people to try and figure out how to solve.
Well, we've got a constitutional amendment in the state that says, as far as Alaska is concerned, you're not married, right?
Right, right. That's true. Yeah, but I feel like on the federal level that so much change is taking place, that soon that constitutional amendment will be very vexed, maybe would be the word, by the fact that, you know, well, what do you do then with this marriage certificate? I mean, it's, how do you treat it? How do we, you know, how do we do it? I got to say the taxes are a real nightmare. But
because you have to do
I don't know.
Single filing separately?
We have to file separately, yeah. And so we have like a house and a kid and a rental. And
it has to all be split in half or something?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of different
okay.
theories on
it. Other practical issues or problems that it creates?
Well, certainly Sarah's a federal employee, so I can't be covered by her insurance. So if I chose to work part-time, which I don't, I wouldn't have health insurance myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we were married, if she were to die, I would be entitled to survivor benefits that I am not entitled mm-hmm. to in the way that things are now.
What about personally? Does it affect your relationship?
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, I think we're pretty much like anybody else. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, I guess if anything, I wasn't taking marriage as seriously as that seriously as a gay person. I was kind of mm-hmm. like, okay, yeah, let's do it, woo! But I already felt committed to my relationship. So, but then once we did get married, it actually kind of changed my mindset. Like I was sort of more, I don't know. I didn't expect mm-hmm. to sort of have it change my mindset.
Same thing for me when I got married. That
yeah.
was a very long time ago.
Yeah. It was really yeah. important to our parents that we get married.
Yeah.
Because it meant something to them. And I'm really glad that we did it for Leo's sake, my son's mm-hmm. sake as well.
And Sarah has adopted him, so
yes.
that you're both officially...
Yeah. His parents.
His mm-hmm. parents, yeah. So how are you finding parenthood?
Exhausting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, though.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the whole thing about being a married lesbian, having a kid, does that... I mean, you talked about being a little bit private.
Yeah.
Do you find that you're under pressure because you're a public person in the newspaper and these things that are such a big part of the current sort of culture war debate are swirling around? Do you come under pressure or do you find yourself criticized or anything like
Not
that?
Not really. Maybe after I do the show. But no. I mean, it doesn't come up like my... personal life does not come up that much, and mm-hmm. it's fun to go on the shows, the conservative talk shows.
Oh, you do that?
Yes, I enjoy it. I like those guys for the most part, because it's harder for them to sort of say that kind of stuff to my face.
Sure.
You know, and they kind of like each other actually.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I mean, I do. I have fun, and you know, and so, you know. Being public about being gay has, for me, been a positive thing, I think.
Is that just a personal thing, or is there any kind of a statement involved in how you...
Well, I guess the politics at their very sort of micro level are only in... Political change is really just relationship-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can only affect the people in our immediate orbit, really.
Yeah.
You know, to make true change inside someone's mm-hmm. heart about how they feel about gay people, they have to know a gay person and they have to love a gay person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a small little realm, really, in which you can affect change. And so, you know, if it's a statement to be out and be kind and ethical, then there you have it, you know?
Yeah. Now, I don't recall you really writing about it much, maybe once or twice.
Yeah, I don't. Because it's not something that occupies a lot of my brain. I don't think about it in the morning. I don't get up and say, oh, so gay today. it doesn't come up for me that
uh-huh.
often. I mean, in this most recent debate about Prop 5, I've been going on the radio talking about it, which is the first time I've really done anything like that.
And we'll be on the air after that's voted, and right
yeah.
now we don't know how it's going to
go. We don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah.
But so that's like sort of the first time I've really been in a public, political way
mm-hmm.
talking about being gay necessarily.
So what about when you were doing that column when you were a teen? I mean, did you know you were gay then?
And kinda.
What was that like being a teen in Anchorage in a big high school? And
I don't know. It was sort of...
Or put it this way, when you made that realization, what were the issues or barriers that you faced?
I mean, it was all tied into, like, my understanding of my politics, you know, and kind of coming into sort of a political consciousness, which has mellowed a lot since then,
mm-hmm.
we'll say that. But you know, I was in a school within a school, which really...
At East High?
At East High, which was like, they were really free to be you and me. Mm-hmm. There's lots of punk rock there. Like, so, you know, but at the same time, I had lots of friends who were, you know, not part of that. And my friends were pretty tolerant and cool for the most part. You know, I mean, as a gay person, you experience insensitivity from people that you love sometimes, not on purpose. And I would say of the times in my life when I experienced the most insensitivity, it was probably in high school, just because people don't know, and they say dumb stuff, and, you know, and I was super sensitive, and, you know, I mean, so it was a little more drama then, but...
Sounds like it took you a little while going off to college to sort of find your way back to Anchorage, professionally, personally, figure out who you were going to be.
Well, yeah, and I don't know that we ever figure out who we're going to be, right? It's an ongoing project. But yeah, I mean, I took about 10 years away from here before I came back.
And you were at Smith College, and then you were in San Francisco freelancing?
No, I was in Portland.
Oh, in Portland.
Freelancing,
okay.
Yeah. And I lived in Juneau, so I went from college to Juneau, to here for a little bit, and then to Juneau, and then to Portland, and then we came back here.
Do you see yourself staying here, or is it just a matter of this is where your job happens to be, and you might move on later if something better comes along?
You know, I don't really know, but this is where my job happens to be. I mean, it's a pretty cool job, even in a time of diminished and sort of uncertain futures for newspapers. So I really don't know what my future holds. It's certainly a nice place to be when you have a kid.
Yeah. Well, it's great. Yeah. And are you an outdoorsy person?
I guess. I mean, who isn't really if you live here? I mean, I'm not like climbing McKinley or anything, but sure, you know, go outside.
Well, how do you, you know, there's people are talking about journalism being a dying art. And that it's people expect to get their information for free. There are fewer and fewer people making their living as journalists. I mean, how do you see that developing, especially in terms of your own career when it's all you've ever wanted to do?
I'm trying to be kind of Buddhist about it. Like, it's very uncertain, but then isn't it all uncertain, right? So I just enjoy getting up in the morning and going to work each day. I feel... in some sense, like I'm sort of an artist with a permanent fellowship. Like I get paid to do, to make art, make creative things, you know, and it really to practice. I get paid to practice. And so I just think I'm lucky to have it, and I just sort of keep my head down. You know, do I think that it's going to be the same forever? You know, I would really like to have some good news. It'd be nice, but it's not going to be the same. There's certainly a hunger for information, and certainly a hunger for narrative, and for stories that come from the place that you live, and to understand better the place that you live. And so if somebody could just figure out how to make money on that, we'd be golden. It's not really my part of the equation is figuring that out, so I'm dependent on somebody making that connection.
You just create and hope that the paycheck keeps arriving in the mailbox or in the bank account.
Or that, you know, what I do still seems to resonate and there still seems to be a place for it, you know.
Well, that kind of raises the question of how you choose. I mean, the stories you choose and the stories you find out about make a really big difference in how people define the city and define living here and what they hear about and what sort of the shared discussion is about. How do you make those choices? How do you
I try, well, David Hewlin, who's my editor, who is like, helps me to go on when I'm discouraged sometimes, his main question is always just, is it interesting, you know, and so that opens up all kinds of things, you know, are you curious about it, is it interesting, and so I just try to meet that standard, and I try to hit a lot of different, you know, types of stories and different types of audiences, because I'd like to sort of serve a variety of readers. I feel a responsibility to do that.
Are you open to somebody calling you up and saying, hey, you should do a column about my grandmother, or hey, you know?
I get calls like that every day, and I would say about, you know, I've really worked hard to cultivate a kind of community around the column that generate story ideas, because, I mean, you've done my kind of work. You can't come up with all of it on your own. Or if you do, it starts getting kind of, you know, stale. Like, so I would say half of my stories, if not more, come from readers. And I'm always happy to talk about it. I mean, I try to, I've written some about it on my blog, but I try to sort of encourage people to pitch stories that are happening now that, you know, would be interesting to other people. You know, the fundraiser that you went to last weekend is, though I'm sure, important and probably not a column, right? So I try to help readers understand what sort of standard columns need to meet. But yeah, I'm
always
happy.
And then you also write a blog, and so you're also, you're really producing more than we used to have to produce before there was...
That's kind of a myth.
Yeah.
You know why? It's just a different type of production.
Yeah.
The stories are shorter. Columns are not necessarily shorter, but the stories are shorter, and there's just more conversation. Things are more dynamic, so... You know, I might put a question out on my Facebook page, and that might start a discussion, and that might make, you know, kick my idea to the next sort of thing, you know, the next sort of level, and make it more complex. And then,
but you welcome people to join in.
Of course, yeah. And then, you know, and then I'll write the column, and then the column will be online, and there'll be discussion in the comment section, and people will write me about it, and that will kick the idea forward, you know. And so things are always changing, and when something's online too, it's not static the way it was when it was just on the page.
And believe it or not, we're out of time.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Went fast. Yeah. I really enjoyed this conversation. My guest has been Julia O'Malley. It's one-on-one. Join us again next week. We'll be having a coffeehouse conversation every week with somebody interesting here in Anchorage. I'm Charles Woolforth. Thanks for being with us.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. Audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. One-on-One is recorded at Kaladi Brothers Cafe at JL Tower. You can watch One-on-One Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on KAKM Channel 7 TV. Or listen Thursdays at 1 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage. Tune in next week for One-on-One when host Charles Woolforth interviews APU professor and backcountry adventurer Roman Dial. This is KSKA Anchorage FM 91.1.